Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Scripts and Scribes live stream Q&A podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Fukunaga. Happy Friday, everyone, for the special Friday episode. Before we get started, we're mixing it up again. And instead of next Saturday, we'll be on next Monday, November 15th at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, with the triumphant return of Lit Manager John Zauzerny for our annual year-end review. But this time, a Q&A version, so please join us then. We're gearing up for the last few episodes of the year, and upcoming guests include, of course, John Zauzerny, the Goldbergs writer and Disney ABC fellow Adeep Desai, Lit Manager and producer Ryan Cunningham of Anonymous Content, and more. So be sure to follow us on Twitter or Facebook so you can keep up to date on all of our future guests. But today, our guest is a Lit Manager and producer who founded First Story Entertainment in 2018 and represents a diverse roster of talented writers and filmmakers who have staffed or sold to HBO, Warner Brothers, CW, Disney, and more. He also develops film and television products under projects under the First Story banner. Prior to First Story, he was head of development and production for producer Linda Obst, whose credits include Interstellar and Sleepless in Seattle. I've actually read her book. And before that post, spent over 7 years in development at Lionsgate. He's a graduate of USC's School of Cinematic Arts and currently sits on the board of the Trojan Entertainment Network. I'm pleased to have on Jason Lubin. Thanks for coming on, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
So we appreciate you coming on. You have an incredibly interesting background in that you are on the lit and producing side, i.e. the buyer, but you've also spent a lot of time in the development side the seller and the buyer, which I think is fascinating and something that I don't think that many writers really consider when they're trying to develop and sell a project. In terms of the needs and what goes on behind the scenes of the development process. Before we get into all of that, though, I did want to say for everyone in the chat, if you've got questions for Jason, please drop them into the live stream chat, and we'll get to them as soon as we can. But I did want to get into your background first. Since you're sure. A first-timer, a new guest here, I wanted to ask you, how did you first decide you wanted to work in the entertainment industry, and how did you sort of make that happen? Like, what's your background like? How did you get into the industry?
Yeah, I've always loved it. I've always loved storytelling. I've always loved entertainment. You know, as a kid, I was reading, I was writing, I was doing everything. All the holidays were at my family's house, and I would write a show. I'd direct it. I'd star in it. I'd put on these old productions. I remember one year for Passover, Star Wars had just been re-released, and I kind of combined the Passover and Star Wars mythology, and I played Moses Skywalker, and I had a lightsaber battle with my dad, who played the Pharaoh. It was like a whole thing. But in fifth grade, I made a movie about George Washington, and I played it in class. And my teacher goes, "This is how Mr. Littigott," and he goes, "This is how Steven Spielberg started." Mm. And that kind of really clicked for me. And I was like, "That's what I want to do." And that's when I decided to go eventually into the film business. So I ended up at, so that was like kind of always the path, always looking for opportunities to really play a part in that field. Mm-hmm. Ended up at USC in the film school there, and realized I wasn't a director when I was there. I was kind of much more producer in terms of my skill set. Mm-hmm. And ended up getting a job. I was a floater at Lionsgate and kind of worked my way up from there. And here we are.
No, that's great. And so, but again, you transitioned from wanting to direct to realizing that producing is probably more up your alley and dealing with your skill set. And now that you've also added to that, you went into development, and then now you are a lit rep and producer. What was that transition like, going from, again, in development side? Which obviously is very not as hands-on in terms of production, which you have, going to film school, knowledge of and experience of, to, again, the very sort of office-driven instead of production set-driven aspect of the film business, and then coming back to sort of an amalgam, which is, I think, what lit reps do.
Yeah, I think you kind of are alluding to it a little bit. I worked at Lionsgate for a long time, and there was a lot of advantages being a buyer, right? Obviously, I could chase material that was certainly at a higher level than as a producer or even right now as a rep. You know, being able to make those decisions is great. You know, I also kind of got kind of the middle ground, you know, working at a small production company with Linda. You know, it was just me, her, and an assistant. So, you know, it was, you know, kind of that hybrid buyer seller being, you know, the middle ground. You know, it kind of, the reason I ended up here was kind of just a confluence of events of leaving Linda. I didn't really know if I wanted another kind of mid-level exec job. I felt I'd done the big buyer of Lionsgate. I'd done the small production company. I had always wanted to eventually start my own thing. So that was certainly in the back of my mind. And I talked with a lot of great people who had made this transition, John Zazerny actually being one of them. And everyone was talking about how great it was being a manager. They're like, you can still produce, you can still do all these things. And so I was like, you know what? That's what I want to do. I'm gonna start my company, build it up. At first, I was like, I'll sign 10 clients, I'll make $100,000 in a year, and then I'll win an Oscar in 5 years when I produce my first movie. And once I started doing it, I kind of really fell in love with the actual, just the pure management side because of that flexibility of being able to do a lot of different things, right? So, you know, I would work my butt off trying to get these projects off the ground, and there's such a small hole to fill. There's, you know, the target is so small these days to be able to sell something, that it got really frustrating when you're, you know, kind of an independent producer trying to really get stuff going. Whereas with these writers, there is so much breadth to be able to do, right? I can try to get them staffed on a show. I can try to sell their original piece of material. I can work in both TV and film for them. I can bring them IP. I can come up with ideas and pitch it to clients that I think might, you know, like that and want to run with it. And being able to do all those different things. And I say, it's kind of funny because I'm a life coach, I'm an agent, I'm a, you know, I'm a producer, I'm kind of a developer. I'm all of those things for 20 people. And that ends up being really exciting. And so I think that's what I've kind of loved about this career path that I chose for myself, is that ability to do all these things that I love, which at the end of the day is just, you know, be instrumental in creating great stories.
Right.
And I'm able to do that in the job that I have now and be compensated for that, right? My goals are purely aligned with my clients. When they make money, when I make money, when their careers blow up and get successful, that helps my business. And I think that, you know, we're not in this give and take at all. It's purely kind of aligned and going forward.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of lit managers come from the agenting side. You come from the development side, which I do want to actually delve into a little bit more. But since you jumped from development to management, and I, in your background, I hadn't seen any sort of agency work or anything like that. How did you learn to be a lit rep? Because obviously it's you're obviously very experienced on the development side, which is a huge part of being a lit manager, obviously, as opposed to being an agent, the development of material and getting it ready for market, and understanding the market and all that kind of thing. But how did you learn the rep side, the representation side, you know, dealing with clients and that sort of thing, you know, from your background?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I kind of say, like, I have no clue what I'm doing, to be honest. And I think that ends up actually working in my favor more than not. When I work for the CEO of Lionsgate, something that he said that's always stuck with me is the worst reason to do something is because that's the way it's always been done. Mm. And I really just live my life that way, in the sense of, like, just because other reps, I mean, I always am asking questions, and I have some great mentors that, you know, give advice, you know, whether they're agents for, you know, other managers, whatever. And I'm always asking questions and always trying, what do you do? Or how do you do this thing? Or, like, do you have a challenge in this way? And if it makes sense, or that's a smart approach, I'm like, okay, I need to start doing that. I'm dumb for doing it this way. I should do it this way. But at the same time, you know, I'm always thinking of like, you know, I'm really try to be like a good, like kind of customer service rep. Like I try to keep my clients happy, but also give them kind of the blunt lines in the way that like, how would I want, if I was a creative, how would I want someone to talk to me about my career and my goals? We're very big on strategy and stuff like that. From the you know, the producer and exec side, I've been on that side. I know what they're trying to do, how it's going to work when you're in that meeting, that they have to pitch their boss, right? It's my job to help them make their job easier, right? Like they're my allies. Like I'm not just trying to make them pay as much, because they're usually the ones I'm talking to are usually not the ones that hold the purse strings. Mm-hmm. So how do I give this exec or this producer ammunition to help my clients move their things forward? And so, you know, I'm very targeted in my approach. I don't call up an exec and say, here's 10 clients that you should all know. I go with a very purposeful, like, oh, I know you're looking for this type of writer, or I have the perfect writer for you. And when they read them, they're like, you were right. This person is great. Or this person is the type, right type. I didn't love this as much as I wanted to, but I appreciate you sending me the right person. So I'm always trying to do what I think makes sense and not tied to, like, there's a lot of things I think in this business that are like outdated or just like, well, why do, like, that doesn't make any sense. Why would mm-hmm. we do things that way? So I really try to operate on what's the smart approach to do it, and how am I doing things differently than my quote unquote competitors? Because if I'm going to do the exact same thing 3Arts does, they're going to beat me every time. So I have to do something a little different and a little more boutique and curated mm-hmm. in order to have my clients get the success that they deserve.
Right. And having such a background in terms of like such a deep background in development, could you walk us through, especially for those writers who may not have gone through any sort of development process or pitching process, that kind of thing, what the steps are for a newer client that you perhaps sign, an emerging writer who hasn't been around the town yet, hasn't been introduced to the town, so to speak, hasn't done the water bottle tour, what that process is like, and then what the process like is for development? Because I think the myth is you send a script to a rep, you love it, you send it out, it's sold, they're on the red carpet, you know, 6 months from now. While that certainly, I guess, could in theory happen, that's not generally the way things happen. It's definitely more circuitous route, and a lot more goes into it. But could you describe possibly, again, coming from, because you have such a great experience, again, as a buyer and a seller, meaning, again, the buyers are the studios, the networks, the people with the money that to give you for your script or your idea, your pitch, whatever it happens to be, hire you as a writer. And the selling side, which is, you know, the writers, the managers, the agents who are trying to get a project together and sold. So can you describe maybe the process that a newer emerging writer would go through to get, like, if something gets made? Just a hypothetical situation of getting a pilot made or feature made from beginning to end, from when they send you that script.
Yeah.
Or even the log line. You get the great log line. You love it, and you want to know more.
Sure. Yeah, I'll do feature, because I think it's great. A little more simple than TV.
Sure.
You know, so I want to be involved with my clients very early on and very actively. Like I read multiple drafts of outlines and treatments and drafts, you know, not as an impediment to the process, but being, you know, especially having, you know, my ear to the ground in terms of what's working in Hollywood and stuff like that, just so if there are any problems or directions that we're going, you know, we can gear this towards kind of, again, aligned with kind of the strategy that the client and I have for their career. So yeah, they'll pitch me. Usually they'll pitch me like, hey, I'm thinking about doing this idea, and they kind of pitch me kind of a general take on it. And I go, oh, that's great. You know, could be cool like this, or maybe ask some questions. And then we develop it, right? You know, outline. Again, different clients have different processes in terms of that. But then when we finally get that solid script that we feel really happy with, that's ready to go out. For features, the first thing I do is I go to, you know, 30 to 50, you know, production, usually production companies, maybe independent producer I know, to get read. You know, if it's the first thing that we're taking out, it's really important to me that just people are aware of this client and that they're thinking of them for other projects in that space, right? So if they're a horror writer, that they're reading a horror script of them, they're like, oh, this is an incredible horror writer. We're going to want to work with them in that capacity. And really be thinking about who are the right producers, who are the right companies that we would go through. So then we take that out, get those reads. I follow up. Of those 50 people, maybe 25 read it. And of those 25, you know, 10 respond well to it. And you know, a lot of them pass, but say, hey, I'd love to meet with the writer. And we set those general meetings. So kind of, again, to get the ball rolling from a general career standpoint. Now, from a for getting this project kind of made, hopefully at least one of these producers really responds to it, wants to make it. They're like, I like this. I want to do it. They hop on board. Usually then there's additional development, the more notes, the producer wants to do their pass and get the script to a version that they want. Once they get that version, where the industry is now, kind of need things to get packaged up. So then they're trying to attach either a director and or an actor to the project to create kind of a package that is competitive, that people are going to respond to. Now, once you get that package, then you take it into the studio. You know, hopefully if they have a home studio, great. You know, they have a deal somewhere that they take it to first. That's always kind of the path of least resistance. If not, they'll take it to the town. And then that studio would option the script. And then we're getting into a little bit of the negotiation, but it's usually there's an option fee against the purchase price fee. So you get money up front, and then there's a purchase price fee if they actually make the movie. And then it's, you know, who knows? It could be a production really soon. Mm-hmm. It could take a long time. It really depends.
Mm-hmm. So I do have more questions in terms of development and all that sort of thing. But I'm going to start going through some of these questions that we've been getting in the live chat. Let's see here. M. Wolf says, any particular genres that are really getting bought up right now? So is there anything hot in particular?
I don't know if there's any particular. I mean, obviously, you know, there's like, oh, people want, like, I think a little more escapist right now. You know, I think there's like some things that aren't working as well. Like, I think like kind of dystopian is not really out. People don't, I don't think, really want virus related stuff, lockdown related stuff. You know, I think the big thing right now is IP, right? You know, either, you know, games, books, franchises, or the things that are going to work are things that are just really unique and special, right? Like if you look at what hits, the Squid Games and the stuff like that, it's things that seem very different than what they've seen before, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to be the Marvel stuff. It's going to be the big franchises, or it's to really cut through. It has to be kind of special.
Right.
And you know, I'm trying not to just chase, because I think what you want to write genre wise is what you are passionate about. You shouldn't write towards, like, obviously you can change a little bit based on kind of what's working. Like, I've definitely told clients like, oh, don't do, what about if we do this current rather than period or stuff like that, to kind of adjust to the times a little bit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think the genre that you want to write is the one that you're most passionate about.
Right.
Because I think people can kind of read through writing to just to market something.
Right. Chasing trends and things like that. Clint Williams. Hey, Clint. Says, is there a pandemic backlog of screenplays optioned or purchased but not yet produced? Does that make current spec market a tougher nut to crack?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, definitely people bought a lot of stuff. I think it's less about overbuying and more just, right, the production, you know, pipeline is backed up, right? They didn't produce stuff for a while. So therefore, they kind of have to get, and they got a bunch of projects to production ready point, right? Because mm-hmm. that's the thing that they were able to do was get stuff ready. And so right now there's just like, you know, production is crazy right now. People are just producing tons of things. So there definitely is backlog. It's very hard, very, very hard to sell things right now. I think for, and again, I don't know your viewership totally, but I think for definitely younger writers or emerging or unrep writers, like that's less the worry. Like my clients, I'm like, sure, it's really hard to sell things right now, but most of my clients are, we're still trying to get producers attached to things. We're still trying to get them staffed on shows. So the level that they're at, you know, it's less about like, oh, it's like, you know, we're not going to get 2 million for this. We're only going to get a million for this deal. We're much more focused on how are we getting people to read your material? How are we getting these projects to a place where they're ready to get sold? And I think definitely for kind of emerging writers, you know, your goal is to get, you know, repped or just get read. And I think, you know, I think there's a little bit, like, I don't time the market. I'm actually talking about this with a couple clients right now. Like, do we take something out now? It's like, it's probably less likely to get sold, but maybe you have a better chance of getting read because there's less things going out right now. Like, that's always the conversation that I'm kind of having, because it's like, you know, our priorities aren't necessarily have to get this thing sold and made. Sometimes there's other kind of goals in line that we have for kind of the long-term trajectory of your mm-hmm. career.
Right. Let's see. M. Wolf also says, from a producer's perspective, how bad of a fiasco is this Alec Baldwin Rust mishap?
From a producing perspective?
I guess so, yeah. Does it have any effect on productions, other productions?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of fiasco, I don't think there's anything worse than someone losing their life. And so obviously, like, you know, I can't imagine, right, the mm-hmm. That situation of someone dying on a set because of you know, the production. You know, I think it certainly has an effect on other productions. And, you know, it's interesting that it happened, right? You know, maybe interesting, maybe coincidental, maybe, you know, kind of to the point of everything that's going on with IATSE and their deal right now of making sets safe and that being a top priority. I think there definitely will be, I mean, hopefully there'll be changes that come out of it. It seems like there's definitely a lot of talk about, you know, how to make sets safer and what changes need to come directly from this. You know, that's a little outside my purview. I'm less involved in terms of the on-set stuff. Mm-hmm. But obviously I hope that there's always, you know, the silver lining to some degree of how, you know, will other lives be saved because changes will be made.
Sure, sure. And again, going back to in terms of how does it affect producers, you don't think that it would have any impact in terms of the material types of material that are getting made? Like, they're not going to shy away from action films because of something like this.
I don't think so. Right. You know, like I said, I think that's opening up all other things in terms of, like, right, like the effects of entertainment on gun violence, stuff like sure. that. I don't think so because, you know, I think the industry, I mean, you know, look at COVID, right? Like, I think it took a while to get productions up again, but when they did, they kind of really did figure out a way to be able to do so fairly safely, right? Right. Like, you know, testing people and masks and all these other things. And so, you know, if anything, when there's money involved, people will figure out a way to do it. You know, will it affect, you know, kind of, I think the thing, but if you look at COVID, kind of to my point of the comparison, COVID has made mid-level budgets really challenging because it's very expensive to do good COVID protocol. So therefore budgets, you know, it's easy for, you know, Jurassic Park and Mission Impossible, big movies to be able to, you know, justify those expenses. If your budget's $10 million and you have to spend $4 million for COVID, that's a huge, you know, thing that you have to kind of take on. You know, will those changes happen for, you know, certain budget movies of like how that affects, you know, gunshots and stuff like that? You know, maybe, I mean, I'm not an expert on visual effects or anything like that, but from the what I've seen or what I've talked to for a couple of people, it seems like it's pretty much like you can make that special effects or the visual effects very easily. And there's certainly no reason to have any ammunition on set. So, you know, I don't know, I'm not a production expert, but I would assume that, they could do that. Will it change unless there's vast consumer sentiment changing? Sure. I don't really foresee it in terms of affecting the types of projects that are made.
Right. Let's see here. How often do you have multifaceted clients like writer, musicians, or writer, cinematographers, etc.?
Sometimes, I mean, musicians, I don't know if I mostly work with writers. You know, obviously I have some that are writer directors. I have a couple that are, you know, that act as well. So, you know, that's something that we certainly are talking about how to, you know, one is kind of, we're about to take it out. It's a comedy that's kind of based on her life. And, you know, and she's a comedian and an actress. So the hope is that she would star in it. You know, I think it certainly, it affects how we position projects, right? I'm always big on, as long as we position it a certain way, right? If you're the one that has to direct this, we'll take it out as you're directing it. You know, if you're acting in it, we'll take it out as you acting in this. You know, and sometimes you have to make the decision over, is that what's the priority? Mm-hmm. You know, because some people might want to do something that you're not, you know, I want to do this with this actress or et cetera. You know, I'm not necessarily opposed to it as long as, you know, we're aligned in terms of what the goals are for you, because if you're 90% a musician and it's just a very small, you know, writing thing, I don't know if I necessarily want to work with that person, because, you know, how much are we able to really do together if this is such a small part of who you are? But if it's something in addition and it seems to work together well, then, you know, why not?
And what is the best way to sort of introduce that aspect of a writer's career goals, their background, in terms of, I've heard that it's having a writer client is more attractive than a writer actor, generally speaking, because it's harder and you do different things. For example, you know, a writer actor, they would have different agents. Like, there's no agent, generally speaking, that represents both lit clients and acting clients. I mean, there are a few, but it's not as common. And so is that something that they should tell you in their query initially, or let you find out that this is a great script, really great, and then they go, oh, by the way, I'm want to be the lead actor and star in it, and surprise you with that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't know, I'm big on, I think you definitely need to all that definitely needs to come out before you're signed, right? Nothing would piss me off more than a client who doesn't tell me things that are relevant to us working together until, you know, you can't really, like, tricking me into signing you is not good for either of us.
Right.
So, you know, to me, you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess you could do a thing where it's like, oh, get them to like you before throwing in something that you feel is negative. But I don't know. I think you put your cards out first because this relationship is so important that, you know, you want to be with the right person. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, I don't know where it's come out of. I'm sure just like it feels like you have to have a rep in order to succeed in this business. And so people are like, I got to trick one of them. I got to get them, you know, I got to hook them. Where I think it's so important about finding someone who just works with you really well and that gets you. And like, I don't rep actors, not because I don't like actors, but just because that's not my expertise. Mm-hmm. I don't have casting director relationships. You know, I don't really know like enough about that field to be very effective for actors if I represented them. And so even the couple people that do act that I represent, you know, I'm really working on them. I mean, we can use writing to further along their acting career. Like I said, this client that hopes to star in this project, but very much I'm giving her advice and working with her in terms of her writing career. Mm-hmm. And so I do know some people that I think that work with a lot more people who are both, or, you know, there certainly are companies, like there's a lot of, I actually talked with a couple that were mainly talent management companies. They were working with actors and they were looking to bring in some people to run kind of a lit arm of their company. Like maybe that's a better fit for someone who, you know, wants to be an actor. So they have a team that is focusing on their acting side because that's their expertise, but also have someone at that company that knows the lit side of the business and can help them with that as well. So I think there's, you know, there's no one size fits all in management. And I think you're better off just being upfront with people, being like, this is who I am, so that the right person responds to that. Mm-hmm. You know, why waste your time with someone that, you know, down the line is going to be like, oh, you're an actor. Oh, I don't really want to work with you because of that.
Right. And do you think that, I don't want to say it's easier because obviously it's never easy, but easier for sort of those emerging talents out there, whether it's an actor or a writer or a filmmaker, to pick one lane and focus on their performing, for example, as an actor or as a comedian, get some traction there and then branch off to be a writer comedian, or again, as a writer, work on that before you decide you want to become a filmmaker. Even if that's your goal from the very beginning, try to get a little bit of traction as a screenwriter, get something sold, get something made, build those relationships, and then sort of transition to, well, I got a film made or sold or whatever. This is another project, but I want to direct this one. It's a smaller, but whatever. Is that something that you would recommend to a client?
I would recommend leading with the one that's the most important to you.
Gotcha.
So I'm not big on, if you want to be a director, starting it with writing.
Sure.
And using that to get to directing. And you know, most people, I think they have their main thing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there certainly are, right? So like, you know, I mean, there's been a couple people that have shifted. I mean, I think Jodie Foster, right, has like kind of shifted. Now she's mainly a director. But most people that do multi things, I think still they kind of are one thing, and then they've added directing, or, you know, they were an actor and they added directing and they added some writing and stuff like that. Obviously now, like, you know, the big thing now is writing for you. So there certainly are a lot of people that write, you know, write their own scripts to direct or write their own scripts to star in, creating their own content. And that definitely has been kind of, I think, a more common thing. But, you know, I think it's better to be like my clients that are directors. That's very much how we're putting them out there, is I'm saying they're a director. Mm-hmm. And, you know, or here's a script I'm taking out, but she's attached to direct. I have a couple clients that have their script that they want to direct, but I'm very much putting them out as a writer.
Gotcha.
She's a writer. We're trying to get her staffed on shows, but she does have a feature screenplay that she hopes to direct. And so we did take that out with her attached to direct it. But in terms of how you're pitching yourself, you know, it's still very much first and foremost kind of what the priority is. I think that's the best way to do it. Mm-hmm. Just because, like, I think it's challenging when you're too spread out, because I think people, I don't know if it's just we're like how we're wired or whatever, but we do box people in. And going back to my experience from the other side, you know, what I say to clients all the time is they're going to put you in a box. So better we tell them what box to put you in than let them decide for themselves.
Right. What box to put you in. No, that's great.
When I was an exec, I in my mind, I'm like, this writer is this type of person, so I want to, you know, attach them to this book or something like that. So people are gonna do it. So better we guide them to the box that we want you to do than kind of the free for all of like, I'm a director, actor, and writer. And then they decide, well, this one's the easiest for me, or the one I'm gonna most respond to. And they decide kind of how to prioritize.
Right. That makes sense. That's great. Let's see here. Theo Luoma, thanks for doing this, Jason. What excites you right now? I'm assuming in terms of material? Projects that are out there. Is there anything in particular?
Yeah. What excites me right now? I think it's a lot of the same. I mean, like, again, when I think very much like a creative executive. And what I mean by that is, you know, we would always have our weekend read meetings on Mondays, and it would be like, you know, Gone Girl had just come out or whatever, and be like, you know, what's our Gone Girl? What's the next thing like that? And, you know, I love when clients come up with a really cool way into kind of a classic genre or type of movie, or, you know, like, you know, what's a cool new way into a heist movie? Mm-hmm. Or like, what is, you know, something we always talk about is, what is Fatal Attraction for the Tinder generation? You know, one of my clients is writing a lesbian rom-com right now. You know, what's the Black James Bond? You know, like, I think there's always cool, fresh, different ways into these things that work. And so whenever someone comes up with kind of a really cool, new, fresh take on something, I'm like, that's really fun. Let's make it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes then I keep pushing, where's my script for this? Or one of my clients, she knows, every time she has to tell me, we were joking about this week. She was like, I know every new idea I have to come up with has to be better than the idea that you want me to write. And so, you know, I just get really excited about certain things like that, that I'm like, I think this would work because people love these types of movies, and this is a really cool, fresh way into it.
Right.
And so that's kind of what always gets me really, really excited.
Right. I've used the example many times. So those who have listened to the podcast before, you've probably heard, or you may have heard it. That was an idea that I had heard, that it's called Nottingham, and basically it was the lead character was the sheriff of Nottingham, you know, a bad guy, does all these terrible things, by the order of the king, you know, takes from the poor, blah blah blah, but at night he became Robin Hood. Like, they were the same person, they weren't arch nemeses of each other, but he became Robin Hood to sort of make amends for being Nottingham, and he gave the money back to the poor. So he robbed from the rich, gave to the poor. But it was the same character, the same person, which I thought was fascinating. A view of Robin Hood, a classic character that everybody knows, but flipped on its head completely. So I just thought that was fascinating. So something like that, you know, and it's
something like that. Yeah. Like, you know, look, how many times has Shakespeare been redone?
Right.
All these, and it's like, you know, is there a way to, you know, and I talk about this sometimes, like, look at old movies, like, look at things from the early 1900s, or look at, you know, books that you read as a kid, or something like that. And is there a way to bring those into the current landscape from a lifestyle perspective, not necessarily even a entertainment perspective?
Right.
You know, what's Romeo and Juliet? You know, what would be the Romeo and Juliet of 2021? So I think there's a lot of ways to retell, you know, I don't know, you know, there's seven types of stories or whatever, but, you know, what's a way to tell these things in a different way than what people have done.
Wasn't 10 Things I Hate About You, wasn't that like based on like Taming of the
That's Taming
Shrew?
of the Shrew, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But something,
Yeah.
again, a modern take of a classic tale kind of
And I,
thing.
yeah, discussing that recently with some clients is, because those were big in the 90s. There was that one. There
Yeah.
was I Love She's the Man. That's the one, Shakespeare. Obviously, all the Romeo and Juliet ones. Like, there's a lot, and I think there's
Yeah.
some opportunities to do that again now.
Yeah. Let's see here. Grey Ghost, in your experience, how important is it for a creative building a career to balance one, catering to specific demographics, and two, carrying out their own unique and unheard of ideas? That sort of ties in what we were talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I can only speak to myself, and
Sure.
obviously different reps might have different opinions, and I do believe at the end of the day you should do what you want to do. So, if I'm wrong, I'm not saying I'm right. I'm just saying how I run my business. I'm a big believer in brand, and I do think brand is important. Again, to go back to how it works on the other side. When you're meeting with people, with everything IP right now, they're thinking, who is the right writer to write this IP? Or who, a lot of my clients are staffing. So who is the right writer to bring into this room to write on this show? And so, yes, your ideas are important and you want to have interesting, great ideas to be able to get people excited about your work. Obviously, selling a piece of material is the goal and helpful to your career. But so much as an early writer is about people thinking of you as a certain type of writer. And now what that is can adjust a little bit. It doesn't have to simply be, period dramas, blah blah blah, but I do tend to prefer or definitely advise my clients to focus on their comedy or drama, or to focus on maybe a certain type of YA or sci-fi or whatever it is. And I think you can kind of build out a little bit from that. You can kind of mold and expand it as you take out some additional material. But we want the right producers, and producers sometimes have their own mandates and preferences and stuff like that, right? So if you're going to, Blumhouse, it tends to be a little more genre focused. And so, we're going to be sending them your genre focused things. We want you working with the producers that work within the genres and types of stories that you do. Because I'm looking at any piece of material that I send out, yes, there's that script that we're hopefully trying to get a producer attached to, hopefully getting made, but I'm also sending it out with the hope of we want you to develop a relationship with this producer. We maybe want you to get staffed on one of their shows. Maybe we want you to adapt a book that they have optioned. So there's always that kind of next step goal or kind of strategy that we're doing, rather than simply this is a great original idea. That's what we want to try to sell, because that's very hard. Things, to actually get things made is extremely challenging. And so again, maybe there's other opportunities that can come out of this if we're a little more focused with that approach.
Right. Let's see here. Tian Theron says, question for Jason, your ideal client, hands-on, lone wolf, etc. What are some characteristics that you, obviously, ideal is sort
Make
of a,
money.
yeah.
I think communication is my ideal client is someone that just we're aligned. I know what they're doing pretty much at all times. It doesn't have to be like every day we have a meeting, I'm giving them notes, I'm hands-on on all their piece of material, but I like to know if we discuss a strategy, we come up with a strategy, we have goals in mind of what we're trying to accomplish. And so as long as you are operating on that and I can operate on that, we're in sync. We're good. I'm doing my thing. Maybe there's an opportunity I find out about and I bring it up with a client. You know, some of my clients I talk to a lot more than others. And it, there's not a pro or negative on either of those. It's really where it gets frustrating or challenging is where, you know, where a client might try to take a sharp left turn or something like that. Then it gets a little more challenging because I'm like, wait, I've been set teeing up these meetings or kind of teeing up these opportunities, and now you don't want to do that. Then it gets a little, and again, nothing to do with how often we talk or not. As long as we're in sync about where we're going, I can be effective for my clients. It's very hard to be effective if I don't know what's going on and I'm just brought in at the last minute when there's a problem, because then I'm like, okay, now we have to kind of, you know, do damage control as right. opposed to looping me in when things start to happen and then I can advise appropriately. Again, I'm fine with you, you know, sometimes just giving you advice, right? I don't have to be looped in, but just tell me, hey, this producer reached out and they want to do this with the project. What do you think? You know, there was a situation where I had a client who wrote something and then the person they wrote it for was I think selling it to someone else and brought my client into that. And I was like, I don't want you to be in the middle of this situation. And it was a little hard because by the time they brought me in, this had already happened. Oh. And I was like, okay, now we have to extricate you from something as opposed to just not let you be in it.
Right.
And so that was, again, it was just a situation where, again, communication, I think, is always key. As long as you guys are communicating what each of you are doing, I think everything will be good.
Sounds good. Let's see here. Clint Williams, do you browse the Blacklist website, Coverfly, Redlist, or other platforms looking for screenplays and writers?
I wouldn't say I scour. I mean, I definitely, you know, I definitely get the emails they send out. You know, I think Blacklist sends spotlight emails on Mondays. I take a look, I peruse what they send out and download maybe one or two if I, you know, am interested in the log lines. Coverfly, same thing. It's, you know, whatever their spotlight writers are. You know, I also have relationships with a lot of the, you know, people running a lot of these platforms. And so, you know, every now and then, you know, I communicate, you know, maybe what I might be looking for, or the types of writers I'm going to respond to. And so they know, they're like, hey, I've been working with this writer. I think they do the type of thing you've mentioned before that you might be interested in. You know, would you take a look? And I always say, sure, yeah, I'll take a look. You know, I just don't have the time. I'm one person at my company right now, and I just don't have the time to spend all day, every day on Blacklist looking at everybody on there.
Right.
Every now and then, like, you know, I'll go on and maybe there's like, oh, I'm looking for this type of writer for some reason. Mm-hmm. You know, I just have to be, you know, my time is valuable and I just have to use it in the best way. And so it tends to be what's the spotlight or what someone I know say there's someone they like that I should check out.
Right. Let's see here. Eva says, does a writer's other work negatively impact your willingness to look at a query or script, i.e., is a published medical writer, medical journal writer, a red flag no-go for you?
No, I would actually say that would be like appealing. Like I should say this. It depends. I don't think it would be a negative. However, I think it could be a positive if you write that. So like Someone who is in the military that writes military dramas is appealing. Someone who was a doctor or is a doctor, I don't know if you're permanently a doctor, that writes medical stuff, that wants to write on medical shows is really appealing because there's always an interest in writers who come from a particular background rather than just, I went to film school and this is what I write. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, your life story ends up being, that affects who you are. And now there's so much emphasis and interest placed on who the writer is. And that's something else I'll say all the time. Yes, having a great idea for a script that you send to me might get me excited to read your script, but I end up signing people way more because of who the person is than just their idea for a screenplay. Because if you just have one great idea, that's not going to, you know, I can't make, you know, unless obviously we can sell that script, but outside of that, I'm looking at someone who I'm going to have a 20-year relationship with as a rep, develop their career, make lots of great things. So I want to know, this is the type of writer I am. This is my life experience. This is how the types of stories. And again, when you're talking about staffing in a room or why you are the right writer to adapt a piece of material, it's because of this life experience, or it's because of these are the types of writers that I go for. Or the types of stories that I go for, that ends up being way more important. So, you know, I would never, if you want to be a full-time writer now, that's what I'm interested in, not at one point. I have clients that I signed that are, I don't know if I should say, they're older, versus clients that you know, are pretty much right out of school. Mm-hmm. So I'm less focused on what else they've done as a negative, but simply, you know, how that impacts them as a writer.
Mm-hmm. And to give Eva an example of something like that, Albert Kim, who's actually been on the podcast, you can go back and listen to one of the old episodes if you want. He got a job working on Dirt, that Courteney Cox show where she plays a magazine editor, because of the fact that he, and I don't think he had screenwriting experience, but he was a writer for People Magazine and editor as well, People Magazine and ESPN, and he had written and been an editor on a bunch of magazines, and that's what Courteney Cox's job was. So for authenticity's sake, they brought in a writer who had written for magazines. So that fits right in. So I don't think writing a medical journal or something would be a negative per se. Like you said, if they're writing a medical show, that'd be even better. Let's see here. Tori Simonson says, I have a called shot project. Only one group does the type of work it is written for. No one in the group can talk to me without an intermediary. Is a called shot something you would do?
A called shot? I don't know what that is.
I don't know that verbiage. I don't know what that terminology means, a called shot. So, Tori, if you're still here, then maybe ask the question again so we can kind of figure out what that means. Let's see here. Tien Theron asks again, if I had a manager previously and it ended amicably, does that make a query more attractive? Or I guess conversely, if it ended badly, does that make it less attractive?
You know, it's hard, because I think sometimes yes, sometimes no. You know, it's tough, because it's like, oh, well, if this person been rep before, clearly they know, you know, ideally they've known a little bit more about the business, or, you know, clearly there was something about their writing that, you know, because I think the same thing about competitions, all these things, it's all vetting, right? At the end of the day, I don't care if you're repped at CAA, like, that's not going to make me sign you because you're repped at CAA. You being repped at CAA makes you appealing, because I'm like, oh, clearly CAA saw something in you in order for that, you know, I'm more likely to like your writing because you're repped by CAA than someone who isn't. So it's all kind of vetting, just again, someone has, competitions, right? Some judges have read your work and think you're good. You know, so there is some benefit to that, but then I'm also like, well, why didn't it work out? Right. Or, you know, is it a tough relationship thing? Is it, you weren't as good as they thought you were? You know, there's so many different, you know, reasons why. I don't know. It could go either way, but again, to me, it's like, it's not going to get me more excited just because you were rep before. I'm going to get excited because of your writing, or because of your background or who you are.
So is that something you would recommend, that they don't add to a query, for example, or mentioning when they first meet?
I mean, I, you know, again, I'm, a manager, I'm not going to, you know, it's probably going to be indifferent for me personally. Mm-hmm. And I can't speak to what other people would necessarily say. You know, I have signed people who have had other reps, and sometimes they end up being, it ends up being good because they see how great I am compared to their other reps. You know, and I think they appreciate, right? It's they're not someone who, you know, sometimes they're a little more, they care more about what it is, who I am and how I work, rather than simply I am a rep, I need a rep, therefore like I'm interested.
Right.
That they clearly are with me because of a relationship, you know, because of the work that I'm doing and the relationship that we have, as opposed to simply I have to have a rep and therefore, you know, I'm interested in you signing me.
Right. And you make a good point though, that sometimes relationships, you know, representative client relationships end based on a client not being able to perform or not as good as the rep had previously mentioned. But then also sometimes it could be the rep. Maybe the client is not satisfied with the treatment they're getting from the rep as well.
Right.
Right. And
right.
You know, and you stand out as much better than that rep. So they came to you instead. Let's see here. Steve Hartman. Hey, Steve. I just signed my first option agreement. Is now a good time to find a manager? Do I need one? What is the best way to find the right manager?
Yeah, so I would say, so first off, congrats. You know, it could be the right time because, you know, you now have some success. And so you can both leverage that into getting some interest while also how do you leverage that success into additional success, mm-hmm. which is always, I think, the best way to use a rep. In terms of like, is it the right time? I think what I've been saying recently, and I think that I believe in it, is we are not, reps, having a rep is not a stepping stone in the business. We are not, it's not like, oh, get a rep, check, get staff, mm-hmm. check. We are a tool to be used to accomplish the goals that you have in your career. And I think a lot of people treat getting a rep as a stepping stone, and therefore I think end up doing it at the wrong time, or just how they approach it is like something they have to do rather than, you know, what it is that you really want from this relationship that is going to help your goals. In terms of when is the right time, you know, I think it's when you are really ready for that next step. So is it, you know, it's not, oh, I want to start really developing my material to get mm-hmm. to a good place. Like, no, join a writer's group and really perfect your craft. You're getting a rep when you're like, oh, like I have this work. People say it's great. You know, I now want to get staffed, or I now want to sell my, you know, sell a show, or I now want to get hired to adapt a screenplay, and I need someone on my team that is going to introduce me to the right people that are able to make that happen. Mm-hmm. That I think is really the right time. And yeah, I mean, it's certainly you can leverage success, right? So like I want to gravitate towards people like who are writer's assistants. So it's like they have good writer relationships, and I'm going to help them navigate that and also build upon their relationships to get more. Mm-hmm. Or someone who, you know, maybe is attached to a couple things. Like one of my clients, I signed her because a buddy of mine was a junior producer on a script she developed. And he's like, hey, been developing this script with a writer. I think she's great. I want, you know, would love to send it your way. She's on rep. Love you to read her work, and let's take this thing out together. Mm-hmm. So those are always like appealing things, because it's not, oh, writer I need to completely start from scratch with, that, you know, I can just build upon some of the success that they built already for themselves, that I end up being additive rather than simply doing all the work.
Right.
And that's kind of, I think, how you should, you know, it's a give and take. You don't get a rep and then you're like, all right, I'm all good. Now go get me a job. It's like, no, now's where the work really starts.
Right.
What are we developing? Who are we going after? What is the game plan? What relation, you know, I ask that everybody I sign, what relationships do you already have? And I look through and I'm like, okay, they're doing this show, or like, okay, this person works with this person. Maybe they can recommend you to that. Like, always thinking about how we're building upon what you already have to something more.
Right. Your job is not to put the gold medal around their neck. Your job is to get them ready for that starting block in that big race in the Olympics.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And does it matter? Or I guess I shouldn't say does it matter. Of course it matters. To what degree does it matter? The producer that, or company that this writer got their option from. In other words, a small independent producer is obviously very different from a producer who has a studio deal, you know, that sort of thing. And how much would it benefit for that producer, even if you don't have a relationship with them, to call you or email you on this writer's behalf to say, hey, you know, I just signed an option on this writer's script. You should take a look at it. They're unwrapped.
Yeah. So I'll do the second part first. Sure. Absolutely. I tend to not take unsolicited submissions. And so, but I'm always taking referrals. Mm-hmm. And so pretty much anyone I know who reaches out to me and says, hey, I got a writer I'd like you to check out, I'll check them out. So it's always better to have someone that, you know, you're working with or that, you know, go to those reps. And it doesn't even have to be, I mean, obviously if Steven Spielberg calls me, the first thing I'm going to be is like, all right, who is this really? What's the prank? Right. But, you know, but I'd be like, of course. And I'd read it you know, not even that night. I'd read it immediately and get back to him in 2 hours. You know, I think it's always good to go through someone else, because, again, going back to kind of that vetting process, it's the rep is going to be like, oh, this producer who is established in the business, like, thinks this person is good. I'm more likely to like it, or, oh, I really want to find something with that producer. Maybe there's an opportunity there. Right. So there's that part of it. On the first part of what does it matter, or how much does it matter? You know, again, it does. Like, you know, certain reps might take a different approach. I try not to let it affect me too much, because I think then I run the risk of repping someone for the wrong reason. So does it matter? Absolutely, right? You know, oh, this person has a deal with Amblin. Like, obviously that's going to be appealing to me and going to make me want to rep that person. However, I really try to get back to, like, I can only rep so many people and still be effective and do a good job. And so I want to make sure I'm repping people that I am so excited about, that, like, I'm dying to work with, that I'm dying to find opportunities for. I know how hard it is trying to get people's careers going when I really do love their work, let alone, you know, and I've seen it. There's some scripts I like more than others, and I'm so much more excited about taking out the things that I really like than the things that I'm less excited about.
Right.
So if I'm not super excited about this person, you know, either the type of writing, or we don't creatively mesh, or just I don't think the writing's as good as I would like, I'm going to pass on it, even though I know I'm kind of giving up on an opportunity, because at the end of the day, I want to be an effective rep for my clients. I can't do that if I don't like material. And, you know, there are successful people in this business, directors and writers, that I don't think they're that good. I don't, whether it's they're actually just a emperor in without clothing, or, you know, they just a different, you know, creative sensibility. You know, I couldn't be an effective rep for them. You know, if I'm giving notes, and also, like, vice versa, if you don't think my notes are good, don't, like, save both of the stress from both of us, 'cause this is not going to be a fun relationship. If every note I give, you're like, oh, that's a stupid note.
Right.
Like, we're just not going to work. Why would you want someone as your rep that you just don't mesh with creatively? Not that either of us are wrong. But just, it's not a fit. So I want to make sure that I'm, you know, and again, you know, it could be a producer, like this junior producer, like, he does have some, you know, he has movies made, and on the producing side, he might have something on the producing, and certainly on the writing side, he's had stuff made. you know, he's not huge, but like, you know, he's a buddy of mine, and like I trust, you know, that he has good taste. So, sure. You know, and I signed her. So it doesn't have to be a huge producer for me to get excited. And it's not necessarily, if it's a huge producer, I'll definitely sign them.
Gotcha. Let's see here. Here's one. Michael Smith, do you represent international clients?
I don't think so. I'm looking at my list right now. I don't think I've, oh no, I have one client who's, a dual citizen, South Korea, US. You know, I'm not opposed to it. It would depend a little bit more on kind of where they want to work. Do they want to work in Hollywood predominantly, or make kind of, are they looking to do more kind of local stuff? I mean, with the expansion of like Netflix and Amazon and these streamers worldwide, it would be a little easier to be doing stuff with, like, you know, local, you know, let's say they were live in India, like Netflix India, or you know, South Asia, or whatever their division is. You know, certainly find those opportunities. I always am a little cautious, more just because where my relationships are, I don't have a lot of relationships outside of the US. You know, not to say that I couldn't build those relationships, but I tend to mostly have relationships here in LA, maybe New York. And so, you know, in terms of how do I help my clients, you know, get their stuff going, that tends to be where we're taking stuff. But I'm well aware of the demand for content worldwide. And it's certainly always interesting to me. You know, I'm really interested in South Asia, really interested in Africa, and where kind of untapped potential is. And so any writer who writes in English, or English in another language in those areas, would certainly be interesting to me, because how do we break them into these expansions that these big streamers are trying to do?
What about assuming a writer based in Australia or Canada or England, India, but wants to work in Hollywood, wants to, you know, get a writing gig, or sell a screenplay to the U.S. market, U.S. studios, streamers, etc.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm not an immigration expert, so sure. You know, we'd have to figure out how all that works. But certainly, like, you know, Canada especially, there is a lot of you know, there's tax benefits from production benefits from having a writer who's Australian or Canada that shoots in those territories. Sure. And so I just signed someone recently that's a dual citizen with Canada. And so, you know, there's been a couple companies that I've talked to that are interested in Canadian writers, because, you know, they can get some of these tax benefits from shooting there if the writer is Canadian. So yeah, I mean, again, like I said, I'm not opposed to it, and I certainly am reading people that are from those territories. But at the end of the day, what ends up being most important is just that I like the writing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if I like the writing, we set a meeting, then it's kind of a discussion over how would this work? What are the goals, and can I be effective? Right. Again, sure. Like if I'm not going to be helpful in terms of the goals that the potential client has, you know, again, I'm probably not the right person if that's the case.
Right. Let's see here. Kay Wu says, are non-IP based stunt specs worth the gamble for a writer if they're not trying to get repped, or if they're trying to get repped, excuse me. So are non-IP based stunt specs worth the gamble for the writer if they're trying to get repped, or will a spec that can actually be sold always be preferable?
I mean, I would say probably something that could be sold is probably always preferable. But you know, it's really how good it is. I mean, you know, it's a stunt script is only as good as it is. So if it's something that everyone in town wants to read and it's freaking awesome, why not? And there's certainly been some people recently that have written, I think that's how he got, there was a script that I read that was, it was Superman. It was like a black Superman who had like stopped MLK from getting assassinated. And then essentially like then goes to work for, you know, the Daily Globe or whatever it is in the show. And he ended up getting staffed on Lois or whatever the new Superman on CW. So, you know, it can work, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there's certainly times when, you know, there was the, you know, I think the eight was a Friends AIDS spec script and the 9/11 Seinfeld one. And so, you know, sometimes there are these scripts that are just, you know, really good and everyone in town wants to read them. And, you know, again, that goes back to my other point of just, you know, I want clients to be writing things that people respond to and then want to meet with, right? That they're like, that sounds cool, I want to read that. And then they read it and they're like, this is really good, I want to meet with the person. That's always the goal. So, you know, I think the danger of it is simply thinking that because you have a clever idea, that's going to get you farther, right? Like the Seinfeld 9/11 is only as good as the script is, you know, like you can get everyone to read it, but what's the point of it if it's a really bad script? Mm-hmm. And so you might run the risk of overinflating how good the script is because the concept is so unique. And I think that runs I mean, it can be with your own original stuff too, but I think that can really run the risk with, oh, wouldn't it be really cool if it was this, and then the script not being that good, everyone's going to read something that's not that good for you, and you also can't sell it. So right. It's, you know, then you've burned all your reads on something.
Right. Let's see here. Do you consider contest placements as a sort of vetting? And then to follow up on that, what level of contest placement and what contests would mean something to you, if any?
Yeah, I certainly, right? Like, you know, again, anytime you place in a contest, it's good. You know, not all contests are created equal. And so certain ones are going to be much more valued than others. You know, both from a query perspective of like, what should you put in there? But also like, you know, I'm not usually reading, you know, quarterfinalists or semifinalists of things if in terms of just outreach. Like I'll look at who wins, you know, Big Break or any of these, and then see if there's any writers that look interesting or scripts that look interesting that I want to check out. You know, what I would recommend, because I'm not going to be pro or against any, but you know, I would look at who are the winners or, you know, the top 10 or whatever it is for these competitions for the last 3-4 years, whatever you can find, and see what happened to those people. Did they get rep? Did any of these scripts go? You also read, you know, who are the judges of these competitions, right? You know, if the judges are, you know, I read for a couple of them. So it's like, you know, if it's judges like me, oh, that's probably a decent thing to enter because I know if I get to that final point, I'll at least get read by established people in the business. And also if the winners are getting repped, you know, it's not guaranteed that's going to happen for you, but maybe there is a real shot that it shows that this competition can potentially lead to opportunities or there might be some value placed in it. Mm-hmm. And so you want to, and I think I said this, I was at AFF a week ago and at the round table, I said, you know, all of these things, all these festivals, all these competitions, you know, putting your thing on the blacklist or anything like that. It's all about creating opportunity. It's not guaranteeing success. Winning a competition never guarantees anything. It's all about how are you creating an opportunity for yourself to get read by the right people and who are going to do the thing that you want them to do, whether it's getting reps, buy your screenplay, whatever. So, you know, it's more to me, it's always like, you know, you enter every contest you could. There's no really downside. I'm never like, oh, you entered the Biloxi screenwriting competition and won. Like, I don't want to read that script. Like, no, like no one, it's never a negative. However, are you spending $10,000 a year on contest entrance fees for contests that don't mean anything?
Right.
So it's more about, are you taking the time and the and using the resources or money that you have to create the best opportunities for yourself? And so you want to make sure that you're going after the right ones so that you don't spread yourself thin on things that aren't going to necessarily lead anywhere.
Right. That's good advice. Let's see here. East Coast Grinder says, since the market is focused more on IP right now, how would a new writer get a chance to work on pre-existing IP since a new writer would not have an extensive track record?
So I think a couple things. I think one, you know, that's not your approach. And so again, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's kind of the hard thing to say, which is like, your focus is not on making $1 million right now. Your goal is kind of just, your goal is to get read and that producers and executives or reps, if you're trying to get rep, are responding to your material and want to work for you. That is success at this point in your career. And out of that comes the other opportunities that are later going to come out. So it's write a great original thing. It doesn't, like, even if it's hard to sell or whatever it is, you know, you want to create something great that becomes a calling card or an opportunity for you to create other opportunities in the future. So that's always, I think, the number one goal. Now, in terms of like, okay, like, let's say I have that and I'm trying to do that, but I still want to work with some IP as well. There's so much IP in this world and there's so much IP that no one's looking at. And so you're not going to get a New York Times bestseller. You're not going to get a big, you know, something that's a remake or, you know, a video game, but there are tons of articles out there. There are tons of books out there. Mm-hmm. You know, there are opportunities to find other, like, you know, more obscure things and, you know, reach out to that writer. Hey, like, you know, a book that you loved as a kid, that maybe got optioned and then reverted back to the writer, or maybe, you know, never, you know, got optioned anywhere, right? Back in the 80s and 90s, TV wasn't what stream, you know, series is now. So, you know, I was saying, what are the books that didn't get made into movies 20 years ago? Mm-hmm. That maybe now can be turned into, you know, series today. Look at The Queen's Gambit that right. was, you know, I think optioned 20, 30 years ago or whatever. So, you know, reach out to that writer. Hey, I've always been a huge fan of this book. You know, I'm a screenwriter. I would love to develop it and see if you can get a free shopping agreement or throw, you know, $100 or whatever it is that they're willing to take. And then off of that, maybe there's an opportunity to work with a producer and find something. Like my clients, I'm saying that to them all the time, right? Because same thing, we're not going to get, there was one article in the New York Times that I saw it. I reached out to a producer, my client, and by the time the guy responded back to me, he was like, there's 10 offers on this thing at the studio level right now. And I don't remember who it ended up going to, but you know, maybe Agbo. So, you know, but I'm always, you know, pitching articles to clients or like, what is a book that they love that we could take into producers? That's something that's not like uber competitive, that goes along with this IP drive that everyone has, but at the same time, they're a little more open to lower level people.
Right. No, absolutely. And while he wasn't a first-time screenwriter or anything, Ian Shore, who's been on the podcast, you might want to go back and take a look at some of the podcasts. He's a client of John Zauzerny's. A producer apparently found some self-published book at a coffee shop in the Himalayas somewhere, and optioned it. And Ian wrote it on spec, was not paid to write it, but, you know, talks with his producer, wrote it on spec, and then they ended up, you know, selling it to Paramount and getting made and all this and that. But again, I mean, he wasn't a newbie. He had a couple smaller credits, but, you know, now he's got a big studio credit with, you know, in a film with Mark Wahlberg and yada, yada, yada. But, so, I mean, that was a piece of IP, was not well known. Again, was an independent book that was found in some Tibetan coffee shop or something like that, that this producer stumbled upon because I guess there was a lending library or something like that and fell in love with it. And Ian wrote it, again, on spec, was not paid to write the script for it. So, but, it, you know, like, as you mentioned, some of these a lot of these high profile Marvel things, they're not going to hire a new writer. Why would they? Right. It's, you run the risk of, you know, messing things up, and they have plenty of writers and they have plenty of money to hire said experienced writers. So, let's see here. Tori Simonson. Okay, so a called shot means you target one specific group because of their specialization. It's basically only a one-shot up or down query with that group, unlike my other writing, not generally marketable work. I don't know if you can unwrap that. I don't know what group means, per se. But
it might be like, I mean, you know, if it's like something like, you know, like if you have an idea, let's say you have an idea for, you know, a piece of Disney IP, you know, is that worth a lot of time, you know, to develop something that you can only take to one buyer, right?
Sure.
Maybe not, right? Like I have a client, you know, we're discussing that, or, you know, it's the up and down of, you know, there's only one buyer. This is that worth the time investing to pitch it to them versus, sure, you know, sure, something that's a little more open. In terms of like, as a rep, am I less interested? Again, like, you know, I'm not signing people based on an opportunity. I'm signing people based on them. I want to sign a writer. I'm not signing a project. I'm signing a writer. So, you know, I'm going to, if you're talented, you know, and I think there is potential for you to, you know, have a successful career, and I can help you along that path to success, that's what I'm going to get excited about, or why I would sign someone. And this opportunity, whether it will affect my decision, yes or no, you know, again, like, oh, okay, let's go for it. Is there a way I can be helpful in that opportunity or not? You know, we'll see. But I think that's less going to affect my decision to rep someone. You know, and maybe the answer to you is like, that's less of a appeal, or it's not going to like push me that much because, you know, again, it's you know, it's one small shot.
Right.
But again, my clients, like, yes, there are a couple things that I'm really that when I signed them, I was really excited about, and we're trying to, you know, a couple that we're waiting to take out, or, you know, that we took out and it was to mixed success. But, you know, all of my clients, it's not like, oh, this didn't work, you know, we're done. It's, you know, there's a long career of stuff that we're trying to do.
Right. Let's see here. Should a new writer trying to break in focus on original idea spec or focus on popular genre? I'm not sure that they're necessarily diametrically opposed.
Yeah, I think you should write. I mean, you should write what it is you want to write. Mm-hmm. You know, if the question is like, should I write something that I'm really excited about, or a little more towards the market? Like, again, I think, you know, what I tell to, I have interns and, you know, I'm always talking to about like how to evaluate material. And, you know, I think something smart to kind of look at is, would I hire this writer to write something else in this genre?
Gotcha.
And I think that's maybe a way to look at it, as, you know, even if this idea, whether it's, you know, it's period or it's something really, you know, it's dystopian or it's something, whatever, really hard to put together right now, would I read this script and be like, damn, this is really good? I would hire them to write Dune, or like I would write hire them to write this action movie or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think that's maybe that's a way to kind of approach it, because again, I'm thinking about reading someone, I'm like, oh, I could put them up for this thing, or oh, I know Netflix is really interested in this type of stuff, or these producers have talked to me about someone in this space, or I have an idea for a project that I think this person would be really right for. So that's always more what I'm thinking about, rather than is this script going to be a $1 million sale?
Gotcha. Let's see here. Tion Theron says, hi, Jason. What's your opinion on posting log lines on social media?
Writer Twitter is so interesting. you know, I think a lot of like what people said is like, you know, I think one to each their own. Like, I think people really overinflate how much these things really matter in terms of the business. You know, the whole like, is someone gonna steal your idea? Like, I'm less worried about people stealing ideas. I'm worried about someone else getting there before me.
Gotcha.
And so if I really have a really unique idea, I hold it a little closer to, well, I should say two things. If you have the script already written, I don't think it really matters as much, because you probably sent it out to people to get read, or you're having people read it. So it's not like you're really hiding anything, because someone's going to read it. And like, also like there's probably five people that have the exact same idea you have. Like, I think people overinflate how original some of their ideas are. Mm-hmm. It's the execution that's really, you know, dependent on it. But when, to my point of saying like, you know, I don't want it to, before my clients write the script that that I do think is a really cool, unique way. You know, it's a female James Bond thing. And it's like, I'm kind of keeping it close. I don't want her talking about it. And I'm not really talking about it much, because I'm worried someone else has that idea and will write it. And it will like speed along their version because they have to get ahead of us.
Gotcha.
And so that's when I'm like, but once I have the script, like I don't need to, you know, hide it. Like, I want to tell people about it because I want them to read it and buy it.
Sure.
So, you know, I think posting something, like if it gets someone interested, great. But you know, I wouldn't necessarily just post all your ideas on social media if you haven't written it, just because I don't know really what the benefit of it is.
Right. No, that's smart. We'll answer one more audience question and then sort of wrap it up. We actually have gone almost 90 minutes. It's been pretty quick. Let's see here. K-Wu, seems like the feature comedy has been relegated to streaming for the foreseeable future. How should comedy writers approach the current market? FYI, I write high concept dark comedy.
I don't think writers should worry about the business side of the industry. You know, your job is to write an incredible script. If it's that good, the business side people, the execs, the producers, your reps will figure it out. And we'll navigate it. You know, I think if anything, where streaming is now, you know, it's what is a Netflix movie? Like, I don't think a Netflix movie is any different, to be honest, than what a theatrical movie was 10, 15 years ago. So this idea of like, oh, with streaming, wherever it is, or, you know, theatrical, like, I don't think that really impacts the creative as much as people might think it would. Mm-hmm. And so to me, you know, I tell my clients not to worry about where things are. You know, obviously in series, there's a little, obviously if you're writing broadcast versus streaming and or premium in general, there's a little bit of a content and structure changes, right? You don't have ad breaks and stuff like that. But, you know, in general, just write great material. If you have a great script that people want, people will buy it. And so I think you should focus a little more on just writing something great than worrying about what the business side looks like on the other end.
Right. No, that's good. And I guess lastly, we'll sort of wrap it up with, what sort of advice would you have out there for those emerging writers to help sort of make their journey easier, better?
Yeah, I think my number one advice is always meet people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people are like, oh, well, I don't live in LA or I don't know people. It's like, you'd be surprised how many people you actually do know or you do have access to. So, you know, whatever school you went to, build relationships there, you know, writer Twitter, go to the Austin Film Festival or go to other festivals, you know, they're right now, everything is still, I mean, we're obviously somewhat meeting in person again a little bit, but still so many things are happening on Zoom. So like, there's an opportunity to meet with a lot of people digitally that opportunities didn't exist like this, if you didn't live in LA, you know, a couple of years ago. And, you know, again, referrals are huge in this town. So if you can build those relationships, you know, yes, Steven Spielberg calling me is obviously going to get me more excited about the piece of material. But, you know, if my interns brought me something or like other, you know, what are assistants at these companies or anyone in town, if there's great material, people want to pass it around. Right. And so, you know, just get to know more people, get to know other writers. You know, I think writers are a unique breed. They're very, they for the most part tend to be very collaborative and friendly. It's one of the reasons I love the Austin Film Festival so much, is because it's so inclusive and just like nice. You know, if your stuff is good, like some of my clients or some of my best people that are sent to me are from other writers. Because they know what good writing is and they want to help out their friends and stuff like that. So, you know, build those relationships. And I think that's always the most fruitful thing to be able to do.
No, that's great advice. So you'll stick around just for a minute as we wrap up here after we wrap up. Great. Be sure to follow Jason on Twitter. It's at First Story Ent, ENT as an entertainment. So it's at First Story Ent. And as a reminder, we're on next Monday, November 15th, instead of Saturday, the 11th, for another manager Q&A, this time for our early annual year-end wrap-up with John Zauzerny. So we'll see you then. Thank you all for joining today. Thank you, Jason. It's been a pleasure. I'll have to have you on again in 2022, because there's still questions on my list that I didn't get to. There's too many audience questions. If you're up for it, I'd love to have you back on.
Sounds great.
And have a great weekend, everyone. We'll see you next time.